On the 19th of June last year, a desperate call for help was made from a small wooden fishing boat bound for Christmas Island. The boat was grossly overcrowded with more than 200 men and boys, mostly Pakistanis and Afghans fleeing the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
For most of us, it was our very first time on a boat in an open sea with no sight of land. Obviously, it was very scary, and calling Australian authorities and seeking their help was the only thing we thought could save our lives.
Over 2 days, they made 16 calls for help to Australian authorities. The boat was in Indonesia's search and rescue zone, so Australia's Maritime Safety Authority transferred responsibility to its Indonesian counterpart, Basarnas. But 32 hours after the first call was made, the man who made it and 101 others were dead.
How can a safety authority, in good conscience, hand over responsibility for people's lives, for saving people's lives, to an organisation that they know is not capable of fulfilling that role?
This question has been at the heart of a recent coronial inquest into the sinking of this boat, the Civ 358, also codenamed the Caniva.
I mean, I think they knew that Basarnas can't effectively respond once the boat is sort of 30, 40 nautical miles off the coast of Indonesia. That's the reality, and we know that.
In fact, off the coast of Java, from where the majority of asylum boats leave, Basarnas, Indonesia's search and rescue agency, has a search and rescue range much shorter than that.
We can't rescue people too far out to sea. We can only go 1 to 5 nautical miles from shore. After that, we can't do anything.
Since 2001, almost 1,400 asylum seekers have drowned between Indonesia and Australia. More than 300 have drowned in the past 12 months alone. Why have so many asylum seekers drowned on their way to Australia, and could we have done more to save them? Hello, and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Jess Hill. In the past few years, hundreds of unseaworthy boats have made the treacherous journey from Indonesia to Christmas Island. When these boats run into trouble at sea, it's now common practice for asylum seekers to call Australia for help. But while Christmas Island is Australian territory, the stretch of ocean between there and Indonesia is almost entirely within Indonesia's search and rescue zone. According to former Australian Ambassador Tony Kevin, Indonesia has neither the resources nor the inclination to rescue asylum seekers at sea.
There is a lack of resources, there is a lack of bureaucratic coordination, there is even a lack of will on the part of Indonesian agencies to do anything about these boats left Indonesia permanently. They're not coming back. And basically, Indonesia washes its hands of these boats the minute they leave port.
But he reserves his strongest criticism for Australia's Maritime Search and Rescue Authority, AMSA. Tony Kevin has been an outspoken critic of Australian search and rescue authorities since 2001, when 353 asylum seekers drowned on a boat known as CivX.
We don't seem to be able to engage in a sustained, morally based critique of why 1,000 people have died at sea in Australia's approaches over the last 4 years. I mean, that is a shocking statistic. It's shocking in the sense that many of these deaths were avoidable.
Were they avoidable? Background Briefing has looked at the circumstances around 4 sinkings over the past 2 years in which more than 400 asylum seekers drowned. What emerges is a disturbing pattern of delays, cover-ups and communication breakdowns, and questions about the adequacy of Australia's response. The people who drowned on the Civ 358, which sank in June 2012, weren't the only deaths that Australia could have prevented. In December 2011, an asylum seeker boat called the Barokah left the coast of Java with 250 people on board. One of them was Esmat Adeem.
I couldn't even find a place to sit. I just sat in the aisle in front of the window.
Esmat Adine fled Afghanistan after his work for Australian and American aid agencies made him a target for the Taliban. After arriving in Indonesia, he went to the Australian embassy to request asylum, but officials said there was nothing they could do. So in the dead of night on December 17, 2011, Esmat Adine got on a boat. Just a few hours out of port, when it was around 40 nautical miles off the coast of Java, the boat ran into trouble.
I was just lying. I was sick. And the water touched my feet. When I opened my eyes, I saw that the boat was capsized. At first, I couldn't believe that our boat had sank. But I saw a toy is coming from the inside of the boat. It's coming like by water. When it comes close to me, I realized that no, that was not a toy. That was a cat. That was a cat named Daniel. Daniel was with his mother. They were sitting in front of me. And after that, when I saw Daniel's body, I realized that, yes, our boat sank and there is no hope for us to be alive.
That afternoon, a passing fishing boat found around 100 people desperately clinging to debris.
They were alive. Most of them were alive. About 100 people were alive.
The small fishing boat was only able to rescue 34 people. Esmat Adine was one of them. He tried to reassure those still in the water.
I shouted on them that, be patient, we go now, we will bring you more boats and they will rescue you.
That evening, Australian agencies became aware the Barokah had sunk. They notified Indonesian authorities because the boat was in their search and rescue zone. Months later, customs officials would tell a Senate estimates hearing that Indonesia had initially declined Australia's offer to help with the search and rescue. But documents subsequently obtained by the Sun Herald under freedom of information laws show that just a few hours after they learned of the sinking, Basarnas, Indonesia's search and rescue agency, asked AMSA to coordinate the rescue response. But AMSA refused, stating that the boat was in Indonesia's search and rescue zone. For 2 days, while men, women and children struggled to survive in waves up to 6 metres high, Indonesia and Australia did nothing. Finally, Basarnas asked again for help. This time, AMSA agreed. Jason Clare, the Minister for Home Affairs, went on ABC News Breakfast to talk up the government's response.
We made the offer yesterday of a P3 surveillance aircraft as well as an Armidale-class patrol boat. The Indonesians have accepted that offer, and so this morning that patrol boat and surveillance aircraft will head into the search and rescue region.
Wild weather is hampering the frantic rescue mission for an asylum boat which sunk overnight off the Indonesian coast. Around 250 people were on board, bound for Australia.
A passing coal carrier picked up another 13 people, but by the time Australian authorities reached the scene, they found no more survivors. A total of 201 people were dead. Survivor Esmat Adine says the response from both countries was inhumane.
People are being killed, and here two governments, they compete with each other. They don't even think that their people are dying in the water.
6 months later, AMSA handed responsibility for another asylum boat in distress to the hopelessly ill-equipped Basarnas. This was the Civ 358, on which 102 people drowned. As we'll hear, their deaths have been the subject of an extensive coronial inquiry. Following this tragic incident, the Australian government made commitments to improve search and rescue coordination between the two countries. Then in April this year, asylum seekers were again left to drown as AMSA and Basarnas failed to collaborate efficiently. The ABC's Indonesia correspondent George Roberts explained.
There are various reports coming through that about 60 people are missing and that there might have been as many as 72 people on board that boat or perhaps more, and that 14 people were plucked from the sea by fishermen. All we've been able to find out so far, unless anything's changed since late last night. AMSA wasn't helping yet, or Australian authorities weren't helping yet, and Indonesia hadn't launched its own search. So it seems to be the same kind of standoff we had last year, where Australia knew there was a problem, Indonesia was incapable of being able to help, and as a result, people are left in the water for hours on end.
58 people are still missing. Then in June this year, another boat sank, this time within easy reach of Australian patrol boats. A customs plane sighted at 28 nautical miles from Christmas Island, just 4 miles outside its interception zone. Approximately 55 men, women and children were seen on deck waving at the plane. After the event, the government claimed the boat had shown no visual signs of distress. But official documents from AMSA's Rescue Coordination Centre, released to Fairfax under Freedom of Information laws, showed that customs had reported the boat as being, quote, dead in the water, and they had been concerned about the boat from the moment they sighted it. Without engine power, these rickety boats commonly capsize. The official incident timeline reveals that when the boat failed to arrive at Christmas Island, the Admiral in charge of Defence and Border Protection Command asked the Rescue Coordination Centre to initiate a search. Tony Kevin.
He was asking AMSA to issue a distress alert, a PAN-PAN, which is one stage below a Mayday. AMSA declined to do so. They said, we're continuing to assess the evidence.
If debris is sighted, AMSA said, the surveillance would then move to a search and rescue phase.
That boat subsequently disappeared. We didn't send out an interception vessel for 8 hours, by which time it was after dark. We found the capsized hull floating underwater 60 miles to the west 2 days later.
There were no survivors. 13 bodies were found in the water, but controversially, Customs and Border Protection didn't retrieve them, citing other operational priorities.
We never recovered any bodies, and therefore there may never be a legal basis for a coronial inquest. What concerns me greatly now is what you might call a systemic culture of scepticism of asylum seeker distress claims, a spirit of we'd better wait and see what happens to this if they're really in distress, because we know very often they're not.
AMSA strongly rejects this. However, the question of when a call for help is deemed to be a genuine distress call was at the heart of a recent coronial inquest. The inquest was into the sinking of a boat known as Civ 358. On June 19 last year, the Civ 358 left the coast of Java, bound for Christmas Island. On the boat that night was 31-year-old Hazara man Ahmed, who'd travelled to Indonesia from the portside city of Karachi in Pakistan. An electric welder by trade, Ahmed had also been a volunteer social worker and a security guard at his local mosque. Background Briefing can't use Ahmed's real name because survivors from the Civ 358 have had their names suppressed by the coroner. Extremist Sunni groups have openly vowed to eliminate Hazaras in Afghanistan and Pakistan. When two of Ahmed's relatives were shot, he decided to seek asylum in Australia because it was the only country he knew of that was accepting refugees. He knew how dangerous the boat journey could be.
Obviously, I was afraid of the boat. I'd heard that many people had drowned in the sea since 2000 and that they were never found. But I had no choice but to take the boat. I couldn't see any other option.
On the night of June 18, he and hundreds of other asylum seekers were driven to a beach in Java. They were told that two small boats would take them out to a big boat anchored several kilometres offshore, which would then take them to Christmas Island.
Two small boats were used to transport us to the big boat. By the time we got to the beach, one boat had already gone, so we were in the second boat. When we reached the big boat, there were people already on the boat screaming and yelling at us, "Don't board this boat, it's already full."
Did you have an option to go back to the shore? Did you want to go back to the shore?
It was a chaotic situation because on one side we had people on the boat screaming at us not to board, and on the other side the Indonesians were pushing us to, come on, get in, hurry up, the police are going to come, come on, we have to go.
There were only enough life jackets for around half the people on board. Ahmed managed to get his hands on one and squeezed into a tiny spot on the deck next to some other Hazaras. The deck was so crowded, Ahmed couldn't even get up to go to the toilet. People sitting below deck said they had to be careful where they put their feet for fear of falling through the floor. Several hours into the journey, the Civ 358 ran aground on a sandbank. When some Indonesian fishing boats stopped to help dislodge it, one of the crew members said he didn't think it was going to make it to Christmas Island and hitched a ride back to the mainland. That night, the sea turned violent.
That night, when rough waves began hitting the boat, I started thinking that it was really going to be very hard for us to reach Australia. As the conditions got worse, I became more and more afraid.
As the boat lurched over 4 metre waves, passengers had to bang pieces of timber back into place. Ahmed hung on desperately, convinced the boat was about to capsize. That night, at 7:52 p.m, AMSA's Rescue Coordination Centre in Canberra received the first call from the boat.
Please, please help me.
Okay.
Help me, 200 with me. Ship is very heavy.
Okay, did you say there's 200 on the boat?
The sea is great. Yeah, yeah, the sea, the water is very...
Okay, I'm trying to help, but I need to know where you are.
The noise from the wind and the engine made the caller's broken English virtually impossible to understand.
I can't understand. Do you speak Indonesian or Arabic? What language do you speak?
Okay, no problem, Arabic.
Okay, you wait. Okay, an Arabic speaker, okay? Okay, I'm gonna put you on hold. Do not hang up.
Dan, the officer on shift that night, needed the caller to give him a clear GPS reading, so he put him on hold and dialed a translation service.
Thank you for calling the Translating and Interpreting Service, TIS National. An operator will be with you shortly. All our operators are busy at the moment. You've been placed in a queue. Please stand by.
Are you able to pick him up from that end and just keep him on the line? Yeah.
National, this is Tani. How can I help?
G'day. My name's Dan. I'm calling from the Rescue Coordination Centre in Canberra. One of my colleagues spoke to you earlier about arranging an Arabic speaker.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've got the person on the line. Are you able to get him on?
Yeah, no worries. Do you know your client code at all for the...
You got the client code on the EPM?
Dan hurriedly read out the code and an incident number.
Okay, no worries. Hold the line now. I'll call through to an interpreter for you, Dan.
Thank you. Come on.
By the time the interpreter answered, the call from the boat had dropped out. It took 3.5 hours of broken exchanges for Dan to get a GPS reading from the boat. The coordinates revealed that the Civ 358 was 38 nautical miles south of Indonesia.
Hello?
Okay, yeah. So your boat, if it's broken, you need to turn back to Indonesia. You are still inside Indonesian waters. If your boat is broken, Christmas Island is a long way away. You need to go back to Indonesia.
Okay.
Okay, are you there?
That's where the recording ends. The RCC contacted Basarnas and asked them to coordinate the search and rescue response. The communication problem was obvious.
Rescue Coordination Centre, Adrian Johnson.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, good morning.
Can I speak with Mr. Helen from Indonesia Basarnas?
Sorry, you've rung the Rescue Coordination Centre in Australia, sir?
Yeah.
You wanted Basarnas, did you?
No. I mean, I'm from Basarnas. My name is Imam.
Oh, Imam, yes. Go ahead, Imam.
Under an agreement between Australia and Indonesia, whoever receives the first distress call is obliged to respond to it, no matter where the vessel is, until the relevant agency is able to take over. But after finding out where the boat was, all AMSA did for the next 7.5 hours was press Basarnas to take responsibility for it. At the coronial inquest into the sinking, AMSA's director, Alan Lloyd, said they didn't launch a rescue response because the calls from the boat were not thought to be genuine distress calls. Background Briefing has dramatised the exchange between Alan Lloyd and the counsel assisting the coroner, Marco Tedeschi. It begins with Alan Lloyd.
RCC Australia was seeking information about the position of the boat. During the several phone calls, received information including the following. The vessel was in international waters. There were 204 male persons on board. No life jackets on board. No EPIRB. No water. The boat was old and had a lot of water. Request help, please help me, and that the vessel was from Indonesia.
Now, can I stop you there? Would that amount to a distress call or an alert call?
In the context of the phone calls, it's what I would call the normal refugee patter. It normally takes us a number of hours to establish basic information. In fact, it can take a long time to get that basic positional, who are you, type of information. And of course, we listen to the context or the tone of the call. If someone's screaming down the phone at us, you know, a mayday call is quite distinct, or a distress call,
yes.
As opposed to the provision of information. So, information-wise, yes, it was looking for some form of assistance. I don't classify it as a distress call.
Alan Lloyd's reference to refugee patter surprised many in the courtroom that day, including Tony Kevin.
The statement by the AMSA chief witness that distress calls were interpreted as the normal refugee patter, that certainly sent a shiver through the whole courtroom. And the insensitivity and callousness of that statement was breathtaking. Apparently, if you're an asylum seeker, you're supposed to be jabbering hysterically. Otherwise, your call of distress will not be taken seriously.
Counsel assisting the coroner, Marco Tedeschi, asked Alan Lloyd to read on. Again, this is a reenactment.
The RCC received more calls from the boat at about 11:06 p.m, 11:26 and 11:28 p.m. The caller advised that the boat was broken on one side.
Can I just stop you there for a moment?
Mm.
Would the information that the boat was broken on one side raise concern with the Rescue Coordination Centre people taking that call?
It was information, yes, it would be considered.
But would that be something that you wouldn't categorise as refugee patter?
Unfortunately, I would classify it as that.
You would classify it as refugee patter?
Yes.
The West Australian coroner, Alastair Hope, interrupted.
Well, if true, it indicated there was a possible emergency.
Oh, yes, Your Honour, that there was a chance, but I note from the transaction it was actually the word little broken, as opposed to broken in the RCC's records.
Alan Lloyd told the court asylum seekers routinely make hoax calls to the Rescue Coordination Centre, and that they generally follow a script. When he was asked to explain what would constitute a genuine distress call, he refused to say, because that was classified information that would, quote, give away how people smugglers can manipulate the system. Background Briefing wrote to AMSA requesting an interview several weeks ago. At the time, that request was refused. They said that as the government was operating under caretaker conventions, they would be unable to participate. But at the last minute, after they learned of specific allegations being made in this program, AMSA themselves requested an interview. Unfortunately, we were unable to speak to anyone from the authority's Emergency Response Division. Mal Larson is AMSA's General Manager of Corporate Relations.
A key issue is to try to identify the precise problem. For instance, is it taking on water, are the engines broken, and the location of the vessel. So that's the key work we go through in the early phases when you talk about assessing a distress situation. It's finding basic information
that did
about
happen
where the vessel is.
That did happen in the CIV 358. There was 16 distress calls, there was indications that the boat was broken on one side, the boat was taking on water, it was low in the water, and that people were afraid that it would imminently capsize. That call was still judged, according to Alan Lloyd, to be a hoax.
No, that's not true. I reject that. We never thought that was a hoax.
He said it was not deemed to be a genuine distress call.
The vessel was 40 miles from Indonesia. We worked with Basarnas and they accepted coordination.
But now, Larson, okay, clear this up for me, because Alan Lloyd made a very significant point that that boat had been assessed as not being in distress. He made reference to hoax calls that the Rescue Coordination Centre receives from refugee vessels, and then said that the calls that they had received from the CIV 358 could be described as refugee patter.
The reality is that many calls from these vessels are giving us information which is designed to facilitate a rescue by an Australian vessel. We understand that. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get picked up by an Australian authority. Our job as a search and rescue agency is to try to ensure that people who are in distress get rescued.
One person who's had first-hand experience responding to asylum boats in distress is retired Navy Lieutenant Commander Barry Learoyd. He spent 2 years commanding naval patrol boats tasked with intercepting asylum vessels on Australia's northern borders.
In my experience, any vessel that puts a radio call out that says that vessel's in distress, i.e. Mayday, and you are in a position to respond to that, then you are bound by maritime law and indeed by just your own values to do so. You've got to react to what you hear and then make a decision once you're on the scene. You can't say, oh, that might just be a hoax call and disregard it. Someone on the water, a fellow mariner, whether that person is an asylum seeker or not, is in distress, and you are duty bound, if you're able to go and provide support to that vessel.
The first call for help from CIV 358 was made to AMSA on the night of June 19. 11 hours later, at 7 o'clock the next morning, Indonesia accepted coordination of the incident. Marco Tedeschi says the hours wasted that night were critical. He spoke to Background Briefing via Studio Link from Perth.
They did a terrific job in the first 3.5 hours in locating the position of CF 358. They did that really well, but they spent the next 7.5 hours trying to transfer the responsibility to Indonesia instead of just issuing an emergency broadcast to merchant vessels. And the evidence of Mr. Lloyd was that within 1 and 8 hours, that merchant vessels would have been able to respond. So they would have been able to get to CF 358 well before it sank. Under the search and rescue agreement between Australia and Indonesia, one of the things that's meant to be considered is who has the greater capability to undertake the search and rescue. So when the transfer of the responsibility took place, they considered the fact that the boat was closer to Indonesia at that stage. Fair enough, but they didn't consider who had the greater capability to respond. And that's one of the factors that should have been considered.
The Basarnas office in West Java is located on the coastline most commonly used by people smugglers. Background Briefing's Asia reporter, Rebecca Henschke, spoke to Rosh Mali, the head of operations.
We have to use traditional fishing boats. If the waves are big and the rescue is close to the sea, we use rubber boats.
Is your Basarnas office capable of conducting rescue operations in the open sea?
These are traditional fishing boats, so they have small machines and we use paddles. We can't rescue people too far out to sea. We can only go 1 to 5 nautical miles from shore. After that, we can't do anything.
People on the boat continued to call AMSA, begging to be rescued.
Every time a call was being made to the Australian authorities, everyone would think and hope that the Australian authorities would say, okay, we are now coming to rescue you. But the moment we'd hear that we are still in Indonesian waters and they can't come, we would go back to feeling hopeless and scared.
The fate of the SIV 358 was now in Indonesia's hands. Marco Tedeschi.
It was very hard to work out what they did, but it was some kind of radio broadcasts that they gave from different places in Indonesia. That was all they did. They didn't deploy a search and rescue vessel, and by the time CF 358 was, 40 nautical miles or somewhere of that order off the coast of Indonesia, they weren't able to do it anyway.
At 3:15 that afternoon, an Australian customs plane conducting routine surveillance spotted the SIV 358. It told the RCC the vessel was low in the water, but there were no visual signs of distress. Footage taken by the plane was shown to the court. Marco Tedeschi.
The boat did seem to be travelling under its own power, slowly but in large seas. And that surveillance was taken from a distance of some kilometres away, covertly by a Dash 8. So the people on the boat wouldn't have known that an Australian aircraft had done some surveillance of them.
As the customs plane covertly observed the SIV 358 that afternoon, the People Smuggling Intelligence Analysis Group met in Canberra. The director of AMSA, Alan Lloyd, and representatives from customs, defence and other federal government agencies collectively assessed that the boat was not in distress. According to official transcripts, what you're about to hear is the last call the SIV 358 made to the Rescue Coordination Centre.
Everyone, rescue bus. Can you please, sir, please?
Yes, I heard that, sir. I heard you want rescue, but I need to talk to you about what is occurring. What is wrong on board?
Are we in Australian water now?
No. Negative. Not in Australia, no. Not in Australian waters. You are still Indonesian waters. You need to come further south. You have some way to go, sir. There you go.
At around 5 o'clock the next morning, a young Indonesian crew member operating the bilge pump fell asleep. The engine flooded with water. One of the passengers cried out, "Wake up!" Within seconds, the boat capsized.
The moment I fell off the boat into the water, my mind stopped thinking. All I could see around me was chaos. People were trying to get onto the debris of the boat, and there were people trying to grab hold of each other, trying to save themselves at the cost of others' deaths.
When the boat flipped over, dozens of people sitting below deck were trapped. As the people struggling in the water fought to grab hold of the upturned hull, an Indonesian crew member tied one end of a rope to the boat's propeller shaft and the other around his waist and jumped into the water to pull people back to the boat. But Ahmed moved away from the boat, hoping his life jacket would keep him afloat.
After a few minutes, when I became more conscious of what was happening, I thought, why am I going away from the boat? I should be nearby the boat if I want to save my life. But when I looked around, there was no boat. The boat was no longer there.
Powerful currents swept some survivors more than 3 nautical miles away from the boat.
In the early morning, I could see the bodies floating on the water. I had to hang on to the bodies because I was exhausted. After 4 or 5 hours, my life jacket had torn apart. Some other people helped me to get another life jacket from a dead body that was floating on the water. I approached the dead body and I took the life jacket off the body.
A customs plane flying over the area sighted them at 1 o'clock that afternoon. Half an hour later, RCC Australia issued an emergency broadcast to ships in the area and dispatched two Australian naval boats to the scene. The container ship, the MV Dragon, arrived on the scene 90 minutes later. Heavy swell slammed the upturned hull violently against the ship, but its crew still managed to rescue 8 people who were clinging to it. Hours later, 2 more merchant ships would arrive and rescue 31 others. When the Australian Navy boats HMAS Wollongong and HMAS Larrakia arrived at 5:30 p.m, they found people in orange life jackets screaming for help and blowing whistles to attract attention. As the sun set that evening, Australian Navy personnel rescued Ahmed from the water.
They treated us very well, I would say more than well. When we first saw them coming, some of our friends could see the Australian flag. We had heard good things about the Australian Navy, and it was proved to be true when they took us onto their boat. They were very good with us.
By the time 110 people were rescued, they'd been struggling for 13 hours in rough seas. In all, 102 people went down with the boat. Customs commissioned an internal report, known as the Buckpit Report, to investigate the circumstances that led to the sinking. It found that AMSA could have been more proactive in helping the boat, especially as the vessel moved further away from Indonesia and would probably have been beyond the reach of Indonesian assistance. Detective Chief Inspector Dave Bryson from West Australian Police's Major Crimes Unit was assigned to investigate the sinking for the coronial inquest. He asked the Commonwealth to provide him with all the relevant documents they had.
When the West Australian Police asked for information, they meant everything, you know, secret, not secret, all of it. And for some reason, which is not entirely clear, the Australian Federal Police indicated that they didn't want the information to be passed on to the West Australian Police.
Half an hour before he was due to deliver his findings at the inquest, Detective Bryson discovered the Buckpit report had been concealed from him. Weeks of painstaking work, much of it duplicating material already in the Buckpit report, had been wasted. Angrily, he told the court he could no longer stand by his findings. Last month, the West Australian coroner, Alastair Hope, ruled the deaths to be an accident, but added that the asylum seekers had been justified in their fears, and that clearly, if a search and rescue response had been initiated significantly earlier than it was, all of the deaths could have been avoided. However, he also found that until the distress phase had been reached, it was not appropriate for commercial shipping, nor realistic for naval vessels, to go and check on the safety of the boat. He was critical of the communications between Indonesia and Australia, labelling them inadequate. Tony Kevin attended the inquest and was there when the coroner delivered his findings.
The coroner was quite scathing of AMPSA's lack of due diligence in checking that Basarnas would respond adequately to the request to it to take on the responsibility for the rescue of Civ 358. He pointed to the failure of AMPSA to check properly as to what Basarnas was doing to implement its rescue obligation, what equipment it had, what it did. He was quite scathing.
The coroner recommended that Australia work with Indonesia to improve their combined search and rescue responses. AMSA Corporate Relations Director Mal Larson says changes have already been made.
Circumstances have changed in the sense that there's a lot closer communication. We have communication officers embedded in each other's organisation, and in fact we have been training Basarnas officers to issue their own broadcast to shipping. Now the situation is that AMSA will routinely work with passing ships if a vessel is seeking assistance, or if there are Australian assets available, we will send them to the scene.
Counsel assisting the coroner, Marco Tedeschi, says it will take a lot more than improving communications for Indonesia to be capable of properly responding to asylum boats in distress.
I think the lesson for Australia is that basically we have the greater capability to respond. Once these refugee boats are more than about 30 nautical miles off the coast of Indonesia or even less than that, you know, really, my view is that we have to take the responsibility for it because we have the greater capabilities.
The question that many people are asking is, if hundreds of Australian lives were at risk in a similar situation, would Australia rely on Indonesia to rescue them? Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research by Anna Whitfeld. Technical production by Mark Don. The executive producer is Chris Bullock. And I'm Jess Hill.